Okay, this is DJ Sweetie. We got Deltron 3030 in the background with Virus. And I'm going to introduce tonight's show. This is In the Meantime. And we talk about worker co-ops and collectives. And tonight we have Jason Lemieux and Arthur Folchef from Eggplant Active Media in Vermont, I guess. Hold on one second. Is that right? You guys are in Vermont? Okay, and let me see here. Let me bring down this music and tell us, who am I speaking with? Is this Jason?
Yeah, this is Jason, and Arthur's on the line also.
All right. And so tell me, guys, tell me what Eggplant is and what is your mission and some of the tools that you use.
Well, we're a worker-owned cooperative that we provide new media services, mostly internet-related services, to primarily the nonprofit sector, with an emphasis on doing pro bono work for smaller grassroots or small grassroots and community organizations. And we do work on a sliding scale. And our mission is sort of to provide high quality work in regards to marketing and branding to organizations that are doing progressively interesting political work and otherwise wouldn't be able to afford them.
Okay, so how did you decide to launch this organization?
This is Arthur. A group of us who are involved in a variety of different media projects, primarily indie media, have been working together as part of the technical collective for indie media for a number of years, and in, you know, those of us who are sort of part of this like loose group of people needed a way to actually fund ourselves to continue doing the kind of activism that we were doing. And so given that we had a lot of technical skills, we were trying to put together a sort of freelance group of people who could do, you know, sort of for-profit work or at least work that was remunerated in order to keep doing what we were doing. Jason and I sort of met coincidentally one night and started having a long conversation about, you know, how one might actually go about doing this, not only in terms of remunerated work, but it worked for organizations that whose missions and work in the world was interesting in the same kind of sense that some of the political projects that we were working on a pro bono basis were. And so that was 2001, and that conversation grew and had a lot of different people involved in it ultimately, but in the last sort of 4 years, it's cemented into a four-person collective, and with a couple other people who are involved in it, sort of who do work on a daily basis, and we actually, you know, make almost a living, and it's kind of exciting.
But there's four of us, and we're all here in Vermont. Arthur and I have an office in Montpelier, which is in central Vermont, and the two other full-time members is a guy named Dave Evans and another guy named Josh Crawford, who have an office in southern Vermont in the Brattleboro area. So the four of us are all pretty local to each other, and I managed to work full-time and make a living at it. So we've been pretty happily successful with it so far.
All right. So you guys, in a nutshell, you guys do websites or other kind of marketing stuff, or what kind of things do you provide? What kind of services?
We do a lot of websites and a lot of web-based services. It sort of runs the gamut from, you know, just branding and logo creation all the way up to really, really large enterprise-level database applications. And so one half of our team is really design-focused, and the other half is really, really database and web application-focused. So we do print design also and general campaign strategy work. But our real strength is in web development.
Right. Okay. And 2001 is when you started. That was a kind of a heady time for kind of a global anti-corporate globalization movement. Was that part of the influence then with indie media?
Yeah. This is Arthur. Yeah, it's really clearly part of the influence. I mean, all of the people who are currently involved and who were involved during the conversations when we were first starting are very much involved in politics, whether within the anti-globalization movement or within other kinds of movements that have been doing social justice work previous to, you know, sort of Seattle in 1999, or which is sort of what, I mean, a defining moment for indie media, which is actually where many of us met each other, which is sort of how, you know, that's sort of where we identify our start, because we met each other that way. But yeah, we're very influenced, and we've done a lot of work independently on indie media. The various members of Eggplant have been involved at various points in a lot of the development around indie media, and we've been involved, several of us have been involved in other kinds of media projects, from local radio shows to community / pirate radio broadcasts, to sort of grassroots print media stuff. So we've all been doing this kind of stuff for a long time, and it made sense for us to sort of figure out, well, you know, there are organizations who are doing this kind of work who need these kinds of services on a professional level, and we're able to, you know, work for them and be able to, you know, sort of make a living doing that while being able to continue doing our activism. So we sort of see it as a sort of very directly connected way of doing politics on some level and doing actual business work.
And how did you guys decide to start your business in Vermont? Was that where you all lived, or was that a hotbed of kind of indie media activism, or were there just a lot of clients there, or how does that work?
Well, in regards to Vermont, for the first 3 years, we were geographically scattered, and the actual membership of the collective was in flux and rotating around a lot. And at that point, we were in our real infancy, and things hadn't really solidified yet. So I grew up here in New Hampshire, and I was living in the Bay Area on and off for a long time and traveling a lot. And it was those, like, anti-globalization movement heydays of traveling a lot. And so people were bouncing around. And then we sort of realized at a certain point that being a virtual worker cooperative or collective it just wasn't going to cut it for us. I mean, the rare times that we would all find ourselves in the same place, a real key moment was during the FTAA protests in Quebec City. Four or five of us ended up all in Burlington at the Vermont Indie Media Center during that time doing media work from Burlington. And that was sort of the first time we were all in the same space and all actually got to work together and realized the efficiency of working together compared to trying to exist online or over the phone. So that really meant a lot to us, and we sort of realized if we really want to make this a legitimate organization that can be effective at what it's trying to do, that we all have to end up in the same place. So I'm not really sure how we ended up here. We just all had various roots back in the Northeast, and, you know, there was a certain level of commitment of, well, you know, looks like it's going to be Vermont, and so we just ended up settling here. I think, you know, Josh was from the Boston area, and Dave was from Maryland, and somehow ended up here, and we just sort of made the commitment to do it.
Are there other worker collectives and kind of co-ops in that area? Is that a unknown or kind of foreign concept over there, or is it actually quite established?
Vermont has a pretty rich progressive history, you know, from everything from sort of Vermont Town Meeting, which is the governance structure of the local municipalities here, to, you know, a very public anti-nuclear campaign in the early 80s, to, you know, very public anti-biotech campaigns in the 90s and early 2000s. So it has a very, as many people know, it's a very progressive place, and there's no end of the number of cooperatives that exist. Actually, in the building that Jason and I have an office in, there's a Black Sheep Books, which is an all-volunteer worker collective bookstore specializing in radical books, and there's also a collectively owned and run cafe, which actually rents the whole building out to all of us. So we're sort of in a very rich community of sort of cooperative and progressive sort of politics.
Nice. What made you decide that you wanted to be a kind of worker-owned or, you know, worker-run cooperative as opposed to maybe a simpler, maybe that's not true, simpler, but, you know, a kind of typical business structure with a president and board and all that kind of stuff? Like, what was the motivation for doing cooperative work?
Well, some of it was purely a practical sort of outcome of how we were trying to work originally, which is simply that we all were in some ways freelancers and very much used to working on our own, and having the notion of having a boss seemed sort of silly, but really the roots are in all of our sort of political dispositions, which is trying to look at the world from perspective of, you know, what are our needs and what are our desires and how do we best, you know, sort of meet them. And the rather obvious conclusion is that, you know, one person isn't going to be able to decide that for an entire group of people. And as an organization, we've really tried to keep the notion of workplace democracy, as much as, you know, that's somewhat of a challenge working in different geographic areas since we don't all work in the same office every day. The idea that we all sort of manage ourselves and work together as a group of people to keep a business going rather than having a single person sort of lends itself to how we actually do work, but it also is, it's an outgrowth of our own sort of political dispositions of really sort of having a critique of hierarchy and having a critique of having one person who owns the means of production and everybody else who works for that person. We are all full partners in the business, and we all sort of share the responsibility and risks of the day-to-day operations. So it's, I'm not sure if that's fully answering your question, but
yeah, the decision was made almost by default, you know, based on where we were politically, and you know, and really thinking ahead of what, you know, how would we have liked our previous workplaces to have been structured, and everybody's had the experience of having an often nice boss or being stuck in a hierarchy like that, where your job doesn't particularly make sense because the people controlling you are out of touch with what you are actually doing or what your skills are or what your passions are. And so to from a creative standpoint, to really allow people to pursue their passions and to be excited and fired up and inspired by their work, it just makes, you know, a ton of sense to form as a cooperative. You know, and you have to have the right people. You have to have, we found, you know, you have to have really self-motivated, accountable, responsible people that are actually, you know, fired up about what they're doing. And if you have that formula, it just takes off. And I think with a degree of efficiency and zeal that most workplaces lack, you know, with a lethargic and uninspired workforce.
Right. Would you say that you guys all had those skills already? Had you already had experience working in co-ops and collectives, or was this new for some of you, or to what degree?
I would say for myself, I hadn't had too much experience working in a cooperative or a collective prior to Eggplant. You know, Indie Media was about the only collective I had been involved with, and really was our training wheels in regards to learning how to work in a cooperative fashion that's decentralized. And that was my only particular experience in working with a co-op or a collective prior to this. How about you, Arthur?
Well, I think different members of the collective have had different levels of experience. I mean, Jason definitely sort of told one story. We've had another member who'd never been in even sort of any kind of situation where there was sort of a notion of workplace democracy, but I definitely have had several different experiences, and another member has as well. And so, there, to some degree, it has been a very much a learning experience. But the thing that sort of keeps coming up for us is that as we've grown as a collective, we've done a fair amount of talking to other collectives, you know, to learn from their experiences and talk to them about their organizing models and talk to them about their sort of, you know, sort of how they put their finances together, to sort of get a handle on, you know, how do people do this. And for us, it's always been this sort of thing of, like, of as much as we talk to other people and get, you know, glean what we can from their experiences, it seems very much that it's a lot of, like, the experience of being in a cooperative is very much tied to what the cooperative does, who is a part of it, and what are the sort of ideas, like, the aspirations of the people who are involved. And that's really been, you know, I think for us, it's been sort of in a defining of our experience of, you know, how this sort of the experience of being in a cooperative has been, is, you know, that what we do and how we do it is really unique. And you know, we've learned a lot from other people, and we keep learning a lot, but we're also learning a lot from ourselves in that process.
Yeah, we often have folks that will contact us being interested in what our governance model is, or our financial model is, and looking for ideas about how to organize, or looking for documents to work from. And we kind of almost consistently have to say, you know, here's how we do it, but it's not going to work for you. You know, I mean, there's just so many possibilities of what you could do with a cooperative model.
Yeah.
And I don't think that anybody does it the same, really. It's really, really particular as to who you are and what you're doing. So there's no quick solution to do it. I mean, we went through, I mean, so much thought and so much planning and so many different models, you know, failed models, before we actually found something that really worked for us. You know, we had these really grandiose, huge internal working documents that were drafted, and, you know, many, many minds consulted, and then what it boiled down to is, you know, well, what do we actually need, and what's going to form organically that we can put on paper? And that's what we learned, is that, you know, it's great to read what's out there and to get inspired and to get some ideas, but it's really going to come down to what works for you.
Well, would you say that there's any kind of fundamentals or principles by which the co-ops and collectives that you've seen definitely operate by? You mentioned, you know, having a critique of authority or centralization. Would you add anything else to that or include that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's the sort of cooperative principles that exist, and those, I think most cooperatives do share those. And I think it really varies. I mean, there's a lot of different cooperatives, you know, here in Vermont. One of the, you know, we have, you know, Cabot Creamery, which is a cooperative, and there's, you know, they do huge amounts of business, and I'm not sure that they're exactly, you know, I'm not sure they'd fall into the category of, you know, anti-authoritarian or, you know, anti-capitalist politics. But, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, cooperatives can do is they can really provide, you know, a workplace with a sense of ownership and a sense of, you know, possibility and a notion that, you know, we, as, you know, as people, as community members, have a right to be able to have a say in the decision-making process about how, you know, the work that we do happens, or, you know, what it means. And that, I think, is maybe the, if there is a common ground between, you know, all forms of cooperatives, which I'm not even sure that there is, that maybe that's what it is. And it's really exciting to see people, you know, get excited about, you know, having some ability to have a say in what they do and how they do it. And that's, it's a really great thing.
Yeah, our newest member, Dave, he came to us not really with too much experience in collective or cooperative organizing, and he had this really crazy background of working all kinds of jobs and wasn't even didn't even know the programming language that we really use a lot, and so he came at it from this burnt out on the .com thing, working construction at the time, and just, you know, sick of really working for a boss, working for the man, and ended up falling into our working with us, and it was, you know, I think a very exciting and inspiring experience for him to all of a sudden be placed in the middle of this this workplace that was so unlike anything he had been used to, and that he had control over and has control over. So it's been a good thing. It was really interesting to begin working with somebody that was coming at this from a different background than the three core members previously had.
So you said you did go through a few models of organizing that didn't work for you, and you, how did you decide to sort of settle on where you're at now? Is that you threw out all the text and just kind of figured out what skills you had, or how did that work out?
Well, some of it was, you know, a lot of us had done a lot of different reading around, you know, how different co-ops have been structured, from like Mondragon to various different kinds of things, and had a lot of really sort of high ideals about how things could work and ought to work, and we tried to come up with governance documents and come up with whole systems of how we'd have assemblies and so on and so forth. And one of the things that we kept running into is that this sort of the gap between the kind of organization that we thought we would be, which we were sort of planning on becoming, and the kind of organization that we were, and that dogged us for a long time. We went through sort of three or four iterations of trying to come up with, you know, functional working documents that, you know, we thought were, you know, expressed democracy, they expressed a sense of egalitarianism, and, you know, as great as those documents were, they didn't ever really mean that much, because we just weren't a big enough organization to have an assembly and to have a governance council, And so ultimately what we've sort of ended up doing is the sort of the reality of, you know, having four full-time people is that we make our decisions in a sort of weekly meeting, and we discuss big kinds of decisions, but we also have a high amount of autonomy between sort of the two major working groups in our organization. And, you know, we're sort of, you know, check in about various different things, but we really let things sort of go as they need to and check in where we can. And that's, at least at this point, we function in a much more organic way than we do, even though we have like an official set of bylaws and so on and so forth. The actual day-to-day practices of the organization are much more sort of organic than any of the models that we sort of initially looked at.
Yeah, I don't think that we've ever actually had to consult our working documents or our governance documents or our grievance documents or anything like that. You know, it's they're there and they're a nice safety net in case something really went ugly, but we've never actually used them. You know, we things just kind of work out without them. And so I think, again, that's about, you know, what kind of people we have and who we are and what we're doing.
Right. Tell me about some of the projects that you've worked on that you've maybe been particularly happy with or that might express some, you know, of the reaching for the higher goals of your organization. What kind of things have you done?
Well, sort of a Bay Area, you know, well-known project would be the website for AK Press in Oakland, which is a fellow collective radical publisher. And that for us was a real turning point or a real pinnacle of sorts, because it brought together a lot of our desires of where we want to be and what kind of work we want to be doing and how we want to do it, in that it was a fellow collective. I believe they're actually technically a cooperative.
Yeah.
And they're very radical, and they were doing something really politically interesting that really aligned with our views of the world. And we offered them a tremendous, tremendous, huge service, and we were able to do it nearly for free. It was done on a sliding scale that, well, it was actually mostly, it was way below actually where our sliding scale even is. So we were able to, you know, through our other work, to subsidize this really radical, great project for a really wonderful organization that, you know, we really admired. And it was sort of this dream project for us, you know, about in concept. And so what it was a, you know, their website had been managed and developed in-house for a number of years, and had sort of had that thing happen that a lot of in-house organic websites have, which is over time entropy takes over, and eventually you're like, oh, it's time for some change. So our really big flagship application is this web application framework called Ministry of Information, which has a large bookstore component to it that was actually originally written for a publisher to power an Amazon-style bookstore for them. It was written for a publisher here in Vermont called Chelsea Green Publishing.
Uh-huh.
That they're a progressive publisher here in Vermont, and so they funded the development of this bookstore software that was released under an open source license. And we were then able to offer it to AK Press for very little money and turn around their bookstore online and retool their database and their book inventory and help them, you know, and do some new design work for them and help them, you know, be more effective and better at selling books online. And in general, getting their message out and providing them with content management system, et cetera. So that was kind of a big, meaningful project for us, in that everything kind of came together about what we want to be doing, how we want to do it.
Who do you usually work for? Is that kind of typical that you would work for a group like AK Press, or is it maybe more kind of big corporations, et cetera, that you'd be actually making some money from?
We do very little corporate work. Maybe, you know, 3% or 4% of our clients are actual corporations, and those are usually interesting lefty businesses that might be doing something interesting. We're sort of stuck in this model or this framework of that a lot of times the corporate work can you know, help fund us to develop some really interesting tools with potentially very interesting radical possibilities. And so we try to take a balance there of taking on corporate work that we feel okay about, and then using those technologies for social change. And so usually we work primarily for a lot of publishers lately we've been working for, doing, you know, book inventory management and bookstore, online bookstores and things like that. And then we work for a lot of small to mid-size NGOs and nonprofit groups doing strategy work and smaller content-managed websites and graphic design work and ads and things like that for them. So there's sort of this, you know, we either have sort of mildly small clients or actually gigantic clients, and there's not much in between. And maybe that's the nature of the web, I'm not sure. But that's primarily who it is. There's, you know, a lot of nonprofits here in Vermont, and a lot in the Bay Area. I used to live there, so tied into a lot of nonprofits there also.
So you've basically been pretty comfortable with the clients that you've had. Have you ever had clients that you're not really fond of, but you're doing it, you know, anyways, because you need to get through the kind of work cycle? Or is it, you know, is there a process of kind of vetting which groups that you're going to work for, or is it really more about who's coming through the door?
Well, we have actually, we do try to keep pretty strict guidelines, at least internally, on who we decide to work for and who we don't. We generally, when we have a job that's coming in or that we've been sort of, romancing, as it were, we talk about it as a collective, and we make a decision about whether or not we'll take it on. Whether or not, you know, when we have requests for sort of pro bono work, we talk about it, whether or not the resources of the collective can be put towards it. And that's, you know, that's something that that's really important to us. So we've had a couple of instances where we've actually turned down work that, that was sort of unpalatable to us. Some of it was due to, you know, people working with the military, which wasn't comfortable for us. We've also worked for people we've ended up feeling less comfortable with, but almost for the most part, with maybe perhaps one client as an exception, we've had just a remarkable experience of people seeking us out who have good politics, who are doing good stuff, or at least stuff that we feel that is, you know, it's worth our work to be invested in it. And that's, we've been really lucky in that regard, and it's been really quite great.
Yeah, we've actually had two examples that I can think of clients. This was really interesting. It took me off guard both times. Of instances of clients actually talking up, if not outright deceiving us regarding what their politics are, because they were interested in working with us. So really talking the talk of lefty politics, dropping names and dropping ideas in the initial phases of you know, talking about doing a project. And then, one of those clients, we just saw right through, and we were like, I don't know what you're trying to do. And the other we ended up actually working for and realizing, you know, learning later that they weren't really walking their talk, and they, this particular technology they wanted us to develop for them, they weren't actually going to turn around and use it for this really great homelessness project that they'd been talking about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So those are really interesting instances of clients romancing us from a political point of view.
And you said that the technology that you developed at, I guess it was Chelsea, and that was open source?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of the software that we develop is under an open source license, and we were involved in quite a few open source projects. And so Chelsea Green, they are technically a corporation. We're actually trying to get them to think about becoming a cooperative, and they're kind of open to the idea. They came to us and were looking for a very, very, very complicated, rich online bookstore content management system, and they were willing to underwrite us to develop it. And we spent, I think, initially 7 or 8 or 9 months developing the system for them that they funded for us, right off the bat, being upfront with them that we want to release it open source and we're going to make it available to people that may even very well be your competition, other progressive and radical publishers, and they were really, really wonderful. They're really great people, and they were really wonderful with, you know, thinking that that was a great idea. Sounds good to them. They'll underwrite the project and let us release it and use it wherever we want. And it, you know, it has actually, you know, the beauty that we've found many times in open source software for the nonprofit and progressive world is that your decision and your investment often comes by and taps you on the back many, many times. And so they've had that experience where we've, you know, turned around and developed a few more features for AK Press or developed a few more features for some different publishers and keep rolling features in and they, you know, they just sort of show up on the Chelsea Green site, you know, and those things will then become available to Chelsea Green. And so they've been really happy with that idea, and it's a really great model that works for us. I mean, the software that the origins of the software of Ministry of Information, our content management system, it has its roots in a project that we developed 3 or 4 years ago for a nonprofit in Berkeley called the Rockwood Leadership Program, and that they then allowed us to release open source and has been really growing since then, and it's come back and helped out many people in the process.
That's great. Well, let's see. We're going to take a musical break now, I think. And when we come back, it would be great if we could talk more with Jason Lemieux and Arthur Fulcia from Eggplant Active Media. And hear also maybe how that kind of segues into the whole idea of competition versus cooperation. You've got a for-profit corporation funding I don't know if you guys are a nonprofit or not-for-profit or for-profit, but basically the open source software, I would say, is more of a kind of a cooperative model of design. And maybe we can explore that a little bit more about how that works, if there's conflicts or if that works into some sort of a contradictory situation or if it flows really nicely. Maybe you guys could talk a little more right now about, you know, the whole kind of open source technology stuff and how that kind of cooperative use of technology helps you in what is essentially, I guess, you know, the larger market as a competitive market. And because I think that's really interesting that a for-profit corporation would sort of underwrite the creation of software that they don't then, you know, consider, if not their own proprietary software, something that they have some sort of a lock on since they did fund a lot of the development. I wonder how, if you see that as a contradiction at all, or if that really makes sense to you.
Okay. Yeah, I think that we could start maybe by giving an introduction of what open source software is and how it works and a little bit about its history. Arthur, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. I mean, this is probably more than we've got time for, and I don't want to bore people. But with open source software, it's really different than what's traditionally called closed source, or sort of what you're referring to, Mark, in terms of software that's developed that's closed, that the actual code that runs it is not available for public use or consumption or change, and sort of like the way you buy Microsoft software, it's just like comes in a box and you can't really do much with it other than what it's prescribed to do. Open source software is a really different kind of model. There's a couple different licenses under which it's governed, but sort of generally the way it works is that along with the program that you distribute, you also distribute the source code or the actual language that makes the thing tick. And that gives people free access to sort of like open the hood and mess around with things. And often it requires a whole lot of knowledge to be able to do it, but the idea behind it, or one of the ideas behind it, is that it allows that for many more people to participate in the software design process than would otherwise be able to. So if you're, you know, a tinkerer or you have a specific need from a piece of software, you can, you know, sort of roll up your sleeves and get involved in sort of the, you know, under the hood kind of stuff that makes programs run. So you can customize something to meet your needs. Or, you know, if you're part of a community of programmers, which most open source software projects are, you can get involved with a group of people who are developing it and start releasing new versions of the software, creating new sort of iterations or improvements and so on and so forth. So in terms of a sort of community model or cooperative model of labor, it's really quite interesting, I think, to look at, because most people do this stuff not for profit, or for, they do it because they either need it, they have a need for it, or they believe in the actual software, or they do it as a hobby because they enjoy it, because they like it, or for a variety of different reasons. Why corporations like Sun Microsystems or IBM are interested in this stuff it's kind of interesting to look at that. I mean, there's a lot of questions about capitalism that come into that, but for one, I think it's, they do get a fair amount of free labor out of it, but they also get some things that are pretty interesting. For one, you get a community of developers who are testing things and trying new ideas out. You get people who are, experimenting or producing things that they might not have thought of in-house. And they also benefit from the sort of the constant production that keeps going, with software, because once you sort of release something into the world, people can keep taking it and using it and remaking it, and software then begins to have a life of its own, at least in the hands of the people who make it. And those people who make it can be a really wide variety of people. So it's really exciting, I think, in terms of that it frees up the possibilities for software development in so many different kinds of ways, and it means, I think, particularly for nonprofits and other sort of progressive organizations who have a lot of sort of specific kinds of needs, the kinds of software that's available to them is actually, in some ways, quite a bit better than would be otherwise. So to that end, I think it's really quite exciting. It's also always interesting to sort of watch the colonization process of, open source software, which has existed for quite a long time, but, it wasn't until the sort of dot-com boom where sort of venture capitalists started getting really interested in, you started having people like IBM, really dumping quite a bit of money into it. Now their business model is actually fairly dependent on it. So it seems to coexist quite happily between, what you might call a sort of community or a cooperative model and a capitalist model. Where it goes, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people who've written a lot of different kinds of analysis of that and where it can go. But as Eggplant, one of the things that we're committed to is using open source software, and we do that because, for one, we think it's politically more interesting. We're much more interested in supporting community software developers than we are in supporting organizations like Microsoft. For two, we find that the quality of software that's available in the world of open source is actually phenomenally good. I mean, Firefox, the web browser, is a great example of an open source browser that's hands down, many, many times better than its nearest competitor, which is probably Microsoft Explorer. I'm not sure, maybe it's something else. But at any rate, it compared to its closed source competitor, is really a much more stable, secure, elegant, well-designed piece of software. And that's, one can look at it and see where their corporation's investing in it and so on and so forth. But it is very interesting to see that. So we see open source software in that regard as being really great for our clients. We also see ourselves as developers, as participating in the creation of open source software is really fundamentally important, because it's part of a process of both creating and giving back to communities of software developers and other organizations in sort of continuing this process of software development. So, we see both the use, development, and need for open source software as a pretty fundamental part of how we engage with both our clients and how we do business.
How do you do business then with that? If a lot of the software is developed volunteer-wise, by volunteers, and where is the kind of, maybe not profit per se, but where is the paycheck in using that technology? Or I guess I'm wondering. Earlier you said you guys are just barely making a living. If you did switch somehow to proprietary, software and tools that you now currently offer, more freely, would that be more healthy for your particular business?
Well, probably not. The sort of we're definitely doing okay, and it took us a long time as an organization to get to a place where we were able to give ourselves paychecks on a regular basis, and that was quite a struggle for us. But then I think that has more to do with us, our immaturity as an organization, and our recent sort of maturing as a sort of real business that is able to sort of provide for us in the way that we want it to. I don't think it's so much this relationship to open source or proprietary source software in that regard. But if we, I mean, one of the ways in which we look at ourselves is that we don't see that ourselves as making money necessarily from software that we solely control. We've been successful so far in our ability to talk to clients and tell them why open source software is better for them, and so far that's worked very well. We've had all of our clients have been willing to fund software, our development process around software, which we then, you know, do release back as open source software. So it hasn't actually been a problem. We haven't had a client say, no, this is, you know, we need to retain intellectual property rights on this particular piece of development. We've actually been able to really convince them that it's in their best interest. And so in terms of an economic model, it's actually worked quite well for us. And largely because we take the time to really explain and work with clients to sort of show them, like, this is why this is good for you. And then on some level it is very much related to sort of the cooperative model, is that really demonstrating that actually this style of development really does benefit you, and it really does, you know, does really come back and assist you in the long run. And all of our clients run on Linux, which is an open source operating system, and they all use, you know, various technologies from PHP to MySQL, which are technologies which are freely available, and that they reap those benefits on a daily basis, and that they're certainly not paying for, you know, every piece of development that went into those pieces of database software and stuff like that. So so far, you know, people have been very receptive, and I think it's sort of reflective of the clientele that we choose to work with.
And in regards to proprietary versus open source software that we would supply to our clients, you know, let's look at Ministry of Information, which is our content management system and bookstore software. You know, I'm sure there's proprietary closed source equivalents available, you know, written in similar languages or maybe different languages that we could, you know, that we could license and pass that fee on to a client and implement for them. But the economics of large-scale open-source software-based web development is that the client is not really paying for the software. They're paying for the implementation of that software. So, for example, Ministry of Information, if anybody wanted to go ahead and download it and build themselves an online bookstore with it, they're welcome to it. It's free. It's available, and you can find it. But the amount of knowledge and know-how that you need to do that is huge. So that's where a client will pay us, is to go ahead and take the software that's freely available and implement it for them, instead of paying a licensing fee for a proprietary piece of software and then paying us to implement it on top of that and incurring two charges. So this way we're offering free software that's, you know, developed and beneficial, you know, has many benefits for the community, and saving money on our end and saving some money for our clients.
Do you then keep a relationship with that client that follows over years while you're updating that, or is that something that you can kind of come in and it's a one-time thing and they can roll with their own system?
We generally keep most of our clients we've had for several years now, and that we try to keep really long-term relationships with our clients, because it's both in our interest and theirs. And that's, again, I think it's sort of like heralds back to the sort of cooperative model, which is that, you know, we're doing work for people, but we're not just someone who's like sending them bills. We're, you know, intimately involved in their businesses in a lot of ways. I mean, and for very much what we do is we build storefronts for people, whether, you know, they're actually selling something or not. You know, it becomes a visible part of their organization. It becomes a way in which people know who they are and what they do. And so it's really important that the clients that we work with are, one, happy with the work that we do, but two, you know, sort of a long-term commitment. I mean, whether, you know, the web's kind of here to stay, I mean, at this point, and so it's something that has become an integral part of how organizations are known, whether they're businesses or not-for-profit, you know, sort of progressive organizations. I mean, it's how you find out about who people are and what they do now. So that's, I mean, that's something that's it's really quite important. So we really pride ourselves on maintaining long-term relationships with people because it's something that's a long-term investment.
And to add to that, some clients do go ahead and take the software that was implemented for them and, you know, and use that ability or use that opportunity to you know, get under the hood and start playing around with things. So an example of that would be AK Press, as, you know, they have some very talented people in-house that that can do a little bit of programming and fiddling, and they've taken ministry information and started modifying it a bit to meet more of their needs without having to pay us to do maintenance for them. So that having that access available for them was really wonderful, and they can really get in there and make it work, you know, the way they want to and tweak things around however they need to.
Right. You said at the top of the hour that some of the inspiration for actually forming Eggplant came out of your work with Indie Media. And as I understand it, you know, you gained a lot of tech skills from that. And at the same time, you know, it's kind of difficult if you're spending all your time doing it a free or volunteer kind of activist project, which I guess maybe we should describe a little what Indie Media is about. But, you know, you want to make Eggplant partly to keep yourselves going. Have you found that, you know, how has your... You mentioned the example of AK Press, but how does your software, your work in general, how has that, do you think, contributed towards the indie media movement? And again, maybe you could describe what that is a little bit.
Well, I mean, indie media, for those of your listeners who don't know, is one of the largest sort of self-publishing projects that's on the web. It started at the June 18th protests in 1999, and then was really kicked off in Seattle in 1999, and November 30th, when the WTO came to Seattle. And what Indie Media was a place where people could write their own stories or publish their own photos or publish their own videos, which at that moment was a really unique thing. Nobody had really done that before and sort of taken the notion of journalism and turned it on its head and sort of handed it back to anyone who had a video camera or a mini disc recorder at the time. And that, as a moment in media history, I think it was really quite unique. A couple of different people who were initially involved in Eggplant, and myself and some of the current members of Eggplant, were part of the tech collective who managed some of the servers, managed some of the software that helped do this. And we spent a lot of time volunteering and really working on keeping things going and in the face of a huge amount of traffic or, you know, sort of very stressful situations and trying to keep sites up and under a lot of duress. You know, we really wanted to figure out, well, how do we do this and also, you know, be able to pay the rent at the same time. So what Eggplant's relationship to this stuff is actually something that's a bit of a debate even amongst ourselves, but certainly one of the things that Eggplant has allowed us, has allowed many of our collective members to do is to be able to get a paycheck and be able to turn around and keep doing the kinds of things that we do outside of, you know, what we do sort of 9 to 5, although we don't really work 9 to 5, we work sort of a much more flexible schedule than that, but metaphorically 9 to 5 for Eggplant. Even though the clients we work for Eggplant we're very proud of, we see this process of Eggplant as really being a place from which we can do more work for the kinds of things that we believe in, and that has supported, one of the people who's involved in Eggplant's, one of the key systems administrators for Indie Media, and others of us have been involved in various different projects, whether it was helping getting computers to various countries in South America, to, helping do designs for various, sort of radical political projects, or lending a hand here and there when, you know, various websites needed some help. You know, last year, Democracy Now! was under a lot of the traffic, and they needed somebody to pick up the extra bandwidth for them, so we did that for a couple of days. And we were able to do that because we've got resources because we're a business, and we have this, you know, we have business class services, and we really work hard to make those, you know, top notch, and so we're able to turn around and hand those over to Democracy Now! When they needed a little extra help, and that was something we're glad to do, and
right.
And that's the kind of thing we want to keep doing, and that's sort of how we sort of, that's one of the ways in which we see our relationships to different movements.
Nice.
Yeah, and the issue though with Egg Plant has been, it was slightly predictable, maybe not though, that the busier we got with Egg Plant and the harder we had to work at making it happen, and now the harder we have to work at keeping it where it is, the less time for volunteer activism we have had, or at least I found that for myself. And so, of course, it's a typical thing. And so that was, for me, initially a little bit of a disappointment that, it was great that now I was making a paycheck, but I was so exhausted by the end of the day that, and so burned out on online organizing that my involvement with indie media slowly fizzled out. And is now, I'm still available for the occasional design project and still do the occasional design project. I think I did a CD cover for Enemy Combatant Radio.
Right.
When the war broke out, I think. And so the occasional thing like that, we're available for. But it was this thing that happened that the busier we got, the less time. So we fixed that up basically by branching out to the amount of online activism and services that we offer. So we're not necessarily just working with indie media now, and we have made a really important point of our model that we, put some money in the bank and set it aside so that we can offer endowments or pro bono work to more radical projects. We've seen a very definite, clear pattern that oftentimes the more radical and politically effective a project is, the less money they have.
Right.
So a lot of the larger, mildly progressive nonprofits can usually pay us a higher rate, and we set some money aside to do plenty of free work for interesting radical organizations. So while we don't get to do as much indie media work as we would like to, we're doing work for, dozens of very interesting radical organizations, oftentimes for free.
Well, to wrap it up here, guys, we only got like a minute or two left here, but where do you see the future of Egg Plant? Do you see yourself becoming maybe a collective of 200 people in 20 years, or do you see, you're kind of more focusing on certain kinds of projects?
I'm not really quite sure where it's going to go. I mean, we've just come to a place in the last, 15 or 16 months where we're stable and turning a profit and making a livable wage and supporting, 4.5 people. And we definitely continue to grow and are in quite a bit of growth, but I think we'd like to stay small and, definitely not 200 people. And I don't really know where the future of Egg Plant's going to be. We're just winging it.
What do you think, Arthur?
I'm definitely excited to see how the organization itself matures. I think we're excited to see other organizations like ourselves forming and having alliances with a lot of different kinds of media providers who are doing work for progressive organizations and really working on improving the kinds of services that are available to progressive and radical movements out there. And I think that's really exciting, and I think it's something that's really improved in the last couple of years. So I'm really excited to sort of see that happen.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm talking with Jason Lemieux and Arthur Folsha from Egg Plant Active Media, based now in Vermont. And wanted to thank you guys for joining us on In the Meantime on enemycombatantradio.net.